Well, welcome to Fort Wayne, everyone. And as you can see, I have a shirt that has my amateur radio call on it. I'm not, you know, promoting amateur radio here. It's just that, you know, I'll be 68 at the end of August, so it's really helpful at times to say, "Hi, I'm Carl." That's right. So that's what that's all about. My wife here is Vicky. She's Alpha Echo 9 Yankee Lima also, and we do a lot of radio stuff, and it's really interesting to come to a new venue that, you know, I was aware of all the shortwave listeners, and it's good to see what's going on here. Okay, Vicky, next slide. Thought I'd give a quick, you know, who am I? I began my SWL career in about sixth grade. I'm pretty sure that's when Mom and Dad bought me an NC60, and that's what's right up there in front. And my, you know, low frequency probably wasn't that big of a deal back in, you know, the early 60s. So I was mostly in the HF, you know, shortwave, international shortwave broadcast stuff. The N660 is a typical five-tube receiver back then, didn't have an RF stage, so you got above, you know, 17 megahertz, and it was pretty quiet up there. As you can see on the front, there's a little white strip of paper, and that's because, you know, we talked about, there was a question about CHU, and when they used to be on 7335, it was real easy to put the main dial on 7335, and then for the old 40-meter novice band, calibrated on that white strip of paper, so I kind of at least knew where I was in the 40-meter band. And it helped because if you're a ham, you remember back then we were just crystal controlled, so you call CQ and you had to listen over a wide range of frequencies to see if anybody called you. I was licensed as WPE9BQH, and that's what that little certificate is. How many other WPE9 or WPEs or VEPEs or whatever the VEs were? But that was quite a deal back then, at, you know, at the young age. I selected K9LA in 77, and I still do like the SWL with vintage receivers, international shortwave. I enjoy listening to aviation frequencies on HF. All the airliners heading over from you know, North America to Europe. In my younger years, I was a airplane and instrument flight instructor, so airplanes were kind of fit into ham radio quite a bit. Okay, next one, Vicky. Now, what we're going to do is just kind of divide this up into two major topics. One is the solar impact of propagation, and then I'll also get into disturbances, which, you know, there's some, Nick mentioned some geomagnetic disturbances. We'll go over that. And I've got a good example. A couple of weeks ago, we really had a major problem with band conditions kind of went you know, went south. What I'm going to do is divide the AM broadcast frequencies up through about 30 megahertz into three major categories. Above 16 megahertz, I'm going to call that the MUF-driven band. We'll get into that a little bit. AM broadcast up to 9, absorption-driven band. And between 9 and 16, the transition bands. Now, those frequencies are not cast in concrete. Things change. But that's a general guideline. And like I said, we're going to also review disturbances to propagation. Okay? Okay, the MUF-driven bands. MUF is short for maximum usable frequency. And that basically tells you how much ionization is up in the F2 region. The region that generally is what provides our DXing, whether it's amateur radio or whether it's just pure shortwave listening. One of the laws of physics is that the absorption in the ionosphere is inversely proportional to the square of the frequency. Okay, so the higher in frequency you go, the lower the absorption. So that's why if you're DXing down in the medium frequency bands, signals aren't, you know, real strong. But as you move up in frequency, you know, if when the sun is really active and we got good HF propagation, that's why those signals are very strong. It all has to do with absorption. Also, another one of the laws of physics is the amount of refraction. Refraction is this bending of the wave. You know, if it didn't bend, it'd just go out into space and, you know, it'd be lost forever unless the university. You know, well, we don't know anything about that yet. It'll come around. Yeah, what comes around always goes around, I guess. Yeah. One of these days we'll be watching Lucy reruns again and all that.
But not in color.
Not in color, that's right. Yeah. Unless there was a red shift, and then it will all be in one of the other. Oh, no, okay. The amount of refraction is also inversely proportional to the square of the frequency. So the higher the frequency, the less the electromagnetic wave bends. So here's a high-frequency wave. It doesn't bend as much. Sometimes it doesn't bend enough, and it goes through the ionosphere and be lost forever. As you go lower in frequency, it bends more. So you don't need as much ionization to bend medium-frequency type waves. And that's what that last bullet is. Size does matter, the size of the solar cycle, that is. And here's some ray tracing results. This is for a daytime condition of very high solar activity. I think you can, yeah, if I can read some of those numbers on there, you can too. I got one here. What I've done is start all the rays at about 2 degrees, pretty low elevation angle. And you can see here's a 14 megahertz wave. What happens is, since we're in the daytime at high solar activity, the E region is going to return it. So it doesn't even get through the E region. And of course, that's a pretty short hop here, maybe, I can't read that, but whatever the bottom is. And as we increase in frequency, two things happen. The hop length gets longer. That's because it's not bent as much, so it's eventually, when it gets bent, it's going to come down farther away, and it gets much, much higher into the ionosphere. So the higher the frequency, the longer the hop, and the less the absorption. That's great. I think that's why a lot of people start out on the shortwave frequencies, the higher shortwave frequencies, because signals are stronger. They don't need these exotic antennas to try and minimize noise, which, of course, noise goes down as you go up the frequency, too. Next one, Vicki. So, I talked about size doesn't matter. So here's a picture of all 24 solar cycles that we recorded, that we have good data on. Good, of course, gets more and more relative as we go back in time to the early cycles. But you can see what this plots is, the solar cycle number versus the maximum smooth sunspot number. And what's very obvious is it's very cyclic in nature. Cycle 1, 2, 3, 4 were kind of big, then 5, 6, 7 were small. Next several were big, next were small, next were big. So where are we headed? Probably for some small solar cycles. Okay. How small? Well, that's an interesting concept that I think we'll get into in a little bit. Next one. Now, here's the duration of solar mins. In other words, what I've defined it as is when the smooth sunspot number goes below 20, how long does it stay below a smooth sunspot number of 20? And you can see this is very cyclic in nature also. The first three cycles were very, the solar min was very short. Then we had some cycles with a solar min in between them that was very long. And where do you think we're headed? Well, we're headed to probably some longer solar minimum periods. Now, if you remember, the previous plot started with high solar cycle, small solar cycle, high solar cycle, small solar cycle, high solar cycle. So there appeared to be some kind of inverse relationship here. Next one. And indeed there is. The longer the solar min period, the smaller the next cycle. Now, I don't know if you remember, but when the scientists were trying to figure out how big solar cycle 24 is going to be. Going to be a big one, a little one? Well, they couldn't agree. So they had two predictions, one for a very high solar cycle, one for a smaller solar cycle. But as the solar minimum progressed in between 23 and 24 and got longer and longer, essentially all the scientists came to the conclusion that cycle 24 is going to be a small one. And in fact, it's in the smallest in our lifetime. Okay, next one. And here's a plot of 23 verses 24. 23 was pretty much an average solar cycle, you know, based on 24 solar cycles, which isn't a big sample to start with, but that's all we got. You can see type cycle 23 had two peaks. Cycle 22 also had two peaks. And you can see 24 had two peaks also. The second peak of cycle 23 was higher than the first peak, and that produced some good, at least for ham radio, 6-meter type opening, F2 type openings over to Europe and Japan. Cycle 24, significantly lower. In fact, it's, like I said, it's the smallest cycle we've ever seen in our lifetime. It had two peaks, that's good. The second peak was sure helped a lot for the higher frequencies. And there's been some early predictions for the next solar cycle. And remember those other slides? Well, those predictions are predicting a small solar cycle, even smaller than this one. But we just went through. So if you're doing medium wave SWLing, you're in the right place. Next one. Okay, so how, you know, what kind of minimum are we going into? Vicki, let's go back a couple solar slides. Let's go back up a couple slides. Another one? Another one. Okay, so here's, you know, what are called grand solar minimums. Several cycles that are small. This is called the Dalton minimum. This one I've seen a name for, but I can't remember what it is at the moment. Anybody? No, the Maunder was a lot earlier. Yeah, but there, I saw a name associated with that, and all you have to do is, you know, point out that, hey, there's a whole bunch of minimums, you get your name tied to it. So, so maybe what I should claim is, you know, this is the Litzel-Schwab minimum, right? Yeah, there's a mouthful. Okay, go ahead again, Vicki. Okay, now, grand solar minimum, you know, that's nothing new. Although we don't have sunspot records, we do have proxies. Beryllium 10 and ice cores and carbon 14 and tree rings, we can correlate that to solar activity if the sun was real active or quiet. And you can see we've had some other solar minimums. Here's that Dalton minimum. There's the Maunder minimum that was the biggest that we're aware of, at least. That was a period had very, if any, sunspots. The sun was very quiet. Of course, there's always the question, you know, back in the, you know, the 1645 to 1705, how good were our observations? But I think it's been very well established that there was a very quiet period of the sun. It seems to have corresponded to a cooler Earth also. So I don't think we fully understand how much the sun impacts our weather. It's an interesting topic, and of course it's being debated today. Again, here's some guys that pointed out, hey, we've had some other, you know, minimum periods, and they got their name tied to it, for Wolf, Oort, and I've never seen anything before that. Of course, you know, this is based on the level of carbon-14 in tree rings, which means you got to have some pretty old trees, and I don't know how old trees can get, but apparently they can get pretty old. You would think that the beryllium 10 that's deposited in ice cores, we could get a lot more data going back in time. Here's an interesting thing. You know, the question: are we going to have another Maunder minimum? And that's going to be a period much less than what we had between 23 and 24, and 24 and 25, and maybe even cycle 26. Yes, Mike?
I find it, and I'm trying to deal with this in my own personal mind. I find that I can tell when there's going to be a good skip, a good sunspot cycle out there because my body, it kind of affects my body. It makes me feel very hyper,
okay,
energetic.
Okay, that could be short-term effects. That could be a long-term effect. But, you know, I think we just don't have a good understanding of how things affect everything else. We're trying our best to understand it, but there could be interesting things happening.
Yeah, I know when it happens. Yeah.
Now, one of the interesting things is we can't see sunspots, which are basically a cool area on the sun, when the magnetic field around the sunspots is less than 1,500 Gauss. Okay, so how do we measure the magnetic field on the sun? Anybody know? Well, it's kind of interesting. Pardon? Well, okay, more what's the physical mechanism, how we measure it? What we do is we look at the spectral line of iron. And in the presence of a magnetic field, the spectral line splits for iron. And how far that splits tell you how strong the magnetic field is. It's called the Zeeman effect. Some guy named Zeeman came up with it. He probably had a dream one night, I bet. Hey, I bet I can measure the magnetic field of sunspots. But one of the facts is we can't see sunspots when those fields are less than 1,500 Gauss. And here's a plot of the magnetic field around sunspots. And since 1998, it's been going down. And that says, uh-oh, maybe the sunspots are going to disappear and we're going to head into another modern minimum. But fortunately, or unfortunately, I'm not sure which one's good, really. But it seems to have leveled off, so it sure looks like we're just going to see some small solar cycles, nothing like a modern minimum, where there are no sunspots. Okay, next. Okay, so here's a quick summary of the bands that are driven by the maximum usable frequency. The next several solar cycles may not provide us very much opportunity on the higher HF frequency, you know, basically 16 to 30 megahertz. And, of course, that includes above 30 megahertz, VHF, UHF also, because F2 propagation can occur on those frequencies at times. Regardless of what the sun's going to do, the best seasons for the northern hemisphere are the fall, winter, and spring, and that's tied to the composition of the atmosphere changing, and that results in different amounts of ionization, too. And again, this is for the higher HF frequencies, not talking medium frequency here. Daytime is generally going to be the best, but several hours past sunset is okay due to the F2 region recombination being much slower than the ionization at sunrise. Just a quick comment about sunspots and 10.7 centimeter solar flux. They're both proxies for the true ionizing radiation, which is at much shorter wavelengths, at least with respect to 10.7 centimeters, about a million times. So 10.7 centimeters of radiation couldn't ionize its way out of a paper bag. But it's a good long-term proxy for that true ionizing radiation at that, though it was very short wavelength. And, you know, Nick and mostly Bill was talking about, you know, the daily variation at sites. And that's pretty interesting. You know, we may tend to think of the ionosphere kind of just sitting there and not doing anything, but it's very dynamic. And it varies day to day. And what's interesting is the daily sunspot number or even the daily solar flux really doesn't tell you what the ionosphere is doing today. There are two other issues that determine what the ionization is going to be over a given point or at least along a path. And that's geomagnetic field activity, which we kind of have a good handle on. But there are a lot of events in the lower atmosphere that couple up to the ionosphere and cause things to vary. So right now, it's very difficult for us to say what the ionosphere is doing today. Now, I think the military probably has a little bit, somewhat of a head start on that. For example, when they do their over-the-horizon work, you know, they got to know what the ionosphere is doing right now. So they assimilate extra data in to try and get a picture of the ionosphere, what's really happening right now.
Very good question.
Sure.
I noticed the degree that you have, it was decided by, what would it be, 100
Yes.
1.1.5, is that one particular spectral line that's on that element?
Yeah, that's Lyman alpha, hydrogen Lyman alpha. And what's interesting is there's a window. Okay, I guess I should talk about the whole of, you know, the ionization process. As radiation comes down, it creates ionization, and it loses energy when it does create an ion pair. So this ionization is absorbed to create an electron and a positive ion. Just so happens at 121.5, there's a window in the atmosphere where that 121.5 just blows right through, and it gets all the way down to the D region. That's what causes it. It's really interesting, and what it does is ionizes nitric oxide, which, you know, there's a lot of that up there, and that's what causes our D region, mostly causes our D region ionization in the daytime.
My own firm for it, the long firm, of course, is a D layer failure within a day, where I'm suddenly, you know, it might be almost immune and I'm destroyed, and I see a WSN bind.
Yeah. Yep. Well, there's...
Especially in the winter.
Yeah, there's a lot of short-term events in the ionosphere that we don't capture in any model. Was it tied to a spike in the geomagnetic activity right before?
No, I didn't check.
No, didn't check. Okay. Because that's one thing we, hams noticed on the 160-meter band, 1.8 megahertz, that things can get really good right when the K-index spikes up, and it has to do with what happens in what happens in the E region, and it has to do with ducting. And I know you mentioned yesterday, someone here talked about ducting and E-skip?
Well, I'm talking about
tri-spheric, okay.
And something else.
Okay, all right. So getting back to this, the longer-term correlation is best, and that's why we use the smooth solar index, like a smooth sunspot number, or a smooth 10.7 centimeter flux, which is basically a 12-month running average, and monthly median ionospheric parameters. So we don't use daily parameters of the ionosphere. It's monthly median, which median implies 50%. So right now, our understanding of the ionosphere is a statistical model over a month's time frame. And we can tell you on average what July is going to look like, but on a day-to-day basis, it's really tough to do that. Next one, Vicky. Okay, now let's get down to the absorption-driven band. Those are below about 9 megahertz. And again, remember that absorption is inversely proportional to the square of the frequency, so the lower in frequency, the higher the absorption. And that's what pushes these guys to nighttime operation on the lower frequency. Now, the amount of refraction, just like we said before, is inversely proportional to the square of the frequency, so you go down in frequency, the more the wave is bent. So you don't need as much ionization on the lower frequencies to refract it back to Earth. Now, the consequences of that, you can see in the ray tracing here. This is for a nighttime at moderate solar activity. And I started down at 0.15 megahertz and went up to 10-something megahertz. Of course, this is at nighttime, so 10 megahertz wasn't bent enough, so it goes through the ionosphere and it's lost forever. But you can see that the extremely low frequencies launched at a low elevation angle, their E region hot. They can't get through the E region. The E region does not go away at night. The critical frequencies are around maybe 0.4 megahertz, so that means it can easily refract even up to 2 megahertz. And you can see as we go up in frequency, again, the hops get longer. They get higher into the ionosphere, and pretty soon they go through, and they're lost. Not too much of a concern for the medium frequency studies, because they're always there. The lower the frequency, the shorter the hop, the more the loft. Now, you got to watch that because as you go even really low in frequency, the wave doesn't get very high into the ionosphere, and it's just a small amount of electron gradient can refract it back, but the absorption process is minimized too. Which means that's why Loran C was a worldwide navigation system down at 100 kilohertz. Of course, you got to put up with noise and inefficient antennas. But propagation down there was pretty good, and also a lot of solar disturbances. Most of them don't get down that far unless it's a really big one. So it was kind of undisturbed by what's going on in the sun, because 100 kilohertz doesn't get very high into the ionosphere. Anything else? Now, I'll make a comment. Like on 160 meters, 1.8 megahertz. And that's one of the big differences between shortwave listeners and hams. You guys care about reception end. Unfortunately, we have to care about both ends. We got to worry about transmit too, transmitting a signal. And when we transmit on like 1.8 megahertz, and I'm sure that this holds true for medium frequencies through a couple megahertz too. Below about 10 degrees, that energy from the antenna below about 10 degrees is basically EHOPs, short, lossy EHOPs. From about 10 to 15 degrees, that's where we can get into ducting. And we're going to get into that in a little bit here. Not tropospheric ducting, but ionospheric ducting. And then above 15 degrees or so, that's when we can take some FHOPs, which could reduce the absorption a little bit. Next one. And that kind of dovetails into, the motel there, the Grayland Motel. How does your signal get from Grayland over to, or from Australia or New Zealand to Grayland? A lot of our thoughts are that it's very, just multi-hop, ionospheric refraction. Reflection from the ground, ionospheric refraction, reflection, just a whole bunch of hops. But you got to remember that these low frequencies have shorter hops and a lot more loss. So you might think, well, maybe there's a limit to multi-hop, and there sure is. It sure looks like it. And we can estimate that using the Frisch transmission equation. And what I did is I did that on 1.8 megahertz. So if we're transmitting 1.5 kilowatts, now that's probably low compared to a lot of your stations you guys listen to. And 0 dBi antennas, which is basically a quarter wave vertical over average ground. The signal goes below the average noise level at 10,000 kilometers. So that's as far as multi-hop can go. Now, when I say average noise level, that usually isn't the noise floor of the receiver. You're usually limited by either man-made noise or atmospheric noise, and that raises it up quite a bit. In fact, I have a Tentec Omni 6 at home. Its noise floor on 1.8 megahertz is about minus 133 dBm. That's pretty low, and it's pretty standard for receivers nowadays. Hold on. And what's the noise level? Well, probably around minus 100 dBm. So there's 30 dB of hearability that's lost because of noise. And that's why, you go through all this stuff to put up these directional antennas with null or very high, very narrow main lobe, but not much off the back and the side. Yes, sir? Yes.
Are you getting to the question from miles?
Yes.
On the ocean.
Well, it depends on. Could be. Yes. This I think is probably a mixture of both.
Okay.
Trying to bound it. So with that 10,000 kilometers could vary, but it's not gonna. It's not gonna make a world of difference. And this ground reflection loss, it could be over water, salt water, could be over ground. And that's another issue with you know, when you guys compare sites, what's the ground underneath the antenna look like? And what's the ground up far out? Mostly in your direction, it's saltwater. But still, there's a, you know, a big impact on the ground right underneath the antenna, and how that impacts your elevation angle, too. So that's just another variable you got to throw in there. I've seen some people actually measure their conductivity and permittivity, and you know, it's not too hard to do, but maybe that would help try and explain what the difference in sites is. You know, one of the differences in sites. That's right. Yeah. Otherwise, yeah. If we ever figure all this out, there won't be any convention, right? Yeah, we're done.
Then it becomes
sideways.
That country AM broadcast.
This issue, 1.8 megahertz, I know I can work the East Coast no problem at noon on 1.8 megahertz with 1.5 kilowatts and typical antennas. So the statement you see that, you know, AM broadcast is limited to daytime only, it probably goes a lot farther than you think. Yeah. Of course, they typically run the highest power during the day, I think, right? And then at night they have directional patterns on their antennas and all that stuff. Okay, this is next. So if multi-hop is limited to something around 10,000 kilometers, at least on 1.8 megahertz, how do we make contacts more, you know, farther distance? Well, that's what we get into ducting. And there is a natural mechanism for ionospheric ducting in the ionosphere. And here's a plot of electron density versus altitude. That's over just a point on the ground. So if you measured the electron density, just going, you know, just you got a big long pole. I mean, really long. What you'll see is at night there's a valley in the electron density. And what you can imagine that is, it's kind of like a piece of waveguide. So the 1.8 megahertz can refract from the top of the E region to in between the top of the E region and the bottom of the F1 region. And it can go long distances, and of course it doesn't pass through the absorbing region. It doesn't suffer ground reflection losses. And we think that's how a lot of the long distance communications on 160 is done. And I don't see why it doesn't apply to you know, medium frequencies up to several megahertz. Next one, Vicky. And here's an example. This was from Sudan, ST0RY, to Fort Wayne. And did a ray trace, and it gets into a duct right out of Sudan. And it stays in that duct, so it's not incurring ground reflection losses, nor ionospheric absorption losses. So it ends up giving a pretty good strong signal. Now, one thing you notice is, well, how does it get down to me? And that's where we start getting into the daily variation of the ionosphere. You know, the ionosphere is not homogeneous by any means. There's probably lumps and valleys all over the place, and depending on what happens above, or well, not exactly above you, but kind of, you know, along the path coming into your QTH, it could get kicked out of that duct with a nice strong signal. Okay, next one, Vicky. Here's where I get a plug for Nick. All right. Coming out of the duct, it sure looks like that's what causes sunrise enhancement. You know, I talk about one way to get out of the duct is just irregularities in the ionosphere, which we have no idea where they are. They're up there probably. But also a tilted ionosphere like a sunrise that could bring a signal out of the duct. In fact, this is one of Nick's recordings of 3QD in Australia on 1548. And you can see the signal strength. I mean, you know, It's not there. It's there for a couple minutes, and it goes away. Now, I have reprints of his article from the amateur radio magazine CEX up there, so if anybody wants them, go ahead and take them. Very good, well-written article, and it explains a lot of what's probably going on. You know, we can't prove it, right? But, you know, when observations and physics mesh, you probably understand what's going on. That's all I can say. Next one, okay. One of the adages that I've always heard is solar minimum is the best for the lower frequency bands that are driven by absorption. Well, beginning to wonder about that. And what it's tied to is the fact that there are galactic cosmic rays. Okay, what those are is very energetic protons coming from the galaxy. They come from every direction, so it's pretty much omnidirectional. But interestingly, at solar maximum, you know, the sun's magnetic field is the strongest, so it keeps those galactic cosmic rays out of our atmosphere. Now, being very energetic protons, that means they can blow right through and get down to the D region and even lower and cause more ionization, which is not good for low band. And on the other hand, at solar min, when the sun's magnetic field is weak, we get more galactic cosmic rays coming in. And this is what this plot here shows. How do we measure galactic cosmic rays? We measure it by counting neutrons, which is one of the byproducts of the collision when this proton hits stuff in the atmosphere. So you can see that, here's a solar maximum. That's when the neutron count is least. That means galactic cosmic rays aren't getting into the atmosphere to cause increased absorption down at D region altitude. And at solar maximum or solar minimum, that's when the neutron count is highest. Well, that's how it follows. But notice what's happened here between cycle 23 and 24 minimum. Of course, we had lots of neutrons getting in, but at our small solar maximum for 24, we still had a lot of neutrons getting in. In fact, more than any of the other solar masses. Now, if you do a little, go through some physics on calculating ionization, you can see, now here's a typical profile of the normal ionosphere, and it should look like that other previous plot I showed. There's a valley, there's the nighttime E region peak, and if you plot how many extra electrons get added by galactic cosmic rays, you can see down in the D region, it's comparable. So it very well could be that the solar minimum between 23 and 24 had more absorption, and that's generally what caused at least us amateur radio operators to say that this solar min that we just went through was not as good as the previous one. Lots of science here to be understood, though. It comes down to the question, can solar minimum be too deep that it impacts our lower frequency propagation? And perhaps it could. Okay, here's a summary of the absorption-driven bands. Nighttime is best. I think all you guys know that, ladies too. Interesting story. When WoWo was a clear channel at 50,000 watts, they had reports from India. That's pretty interesting. Of course, you know, WoWo, I don't, are you guys going to go visit their antenna site?
Yeah.
You know, they went around the area looking for the best ground conductivity, and they found it, and it helped. And it just shows that, you know, when you're comparing two sites, you got to know what's underneath there. And here's some reprints of an article I wrote about ducting and spotlight propagation. Spotlight being, you know, this area's got propagation, this one over here doesn't. What's going on? So there's some reprints of that, too. If anybody's interested. Next one. The transition bands. Okay, they're roughly 9 megahertz to 16 megahertz, roughly. They're not as dependent on the MUF as the higher frequency bands, and likewise, they're not as dependent on absorption as the lower frequency bands. Generally, they're good at solar min, at solar max, and during the day and during the night. Very general statements, but you know, I think you understand what I'm trying to portray here. And that's why in my SWL, my early SWL days, that I enjoyed 31 meters and 25 meters, and even 19 meters fell into that. And at the time, they were really good all-around frequencies for international shortwave listening. I don't know if that's true nowadays or not. Any comments?
Nobody on the air.
Nobody's on the air, yeah. There's not as many as there used to be. They're on the internet, yeah. And those bands are open all the time, right? Yeah, that too, yeah. You could probably identify the... Okay. Next one, David. Okay, disturbances to propagation. I'll let you read that comment. It's pretty good. Yeah. That's a comic. It was called... oh, heck, I forgot. Something rocket. Roger Rocket, or I don't know, I can't remember. But it's a pretty good comic. And in 2002, NOAA defined three categories of disturbances to propagation, okay? I think that was a great simplification of what the heck's going on up there and how it affects our Earth. they were G, S, and R. And all three of these disturbances were caused by just basically two things, coronal mass ejections or a coronal hole and big solar flares. So G refers to a geomagnetic storm, and it's caused by gusts in the solar wind from coronal mass ejections and high-speed streams from a coronal hole. Coronal mass ejections occur mostly around sunspot maximum. Okay, coronal holes generally occur on the declining phase of the solar cycle, and they tend to be recurrent as the sun rotates, so they're probably a little bit worse than CMEs. CMEs can be bad, but they're kind of short-term, relatively speaking. Of course, a geomagnetic storm can cause auroral absorption, depleted F region. But on the good side, you know, you can do some good VHF work during a good geomagnetic storm. S refers to solar radiation storms. When there's a big solar flare, it can spit out some very energetic protons, and that can increase the B region absorption in the polar cap because the protons are funneled along magnetic field lines, which define the auroral oval. R refers to radio blackouts, and that's, again, a big solar flare can emit X-rays, so electromagnetic radiation, as opposed to particles, as in solar radiation storms, can cause more D-region absorptions also. For all three, a scale is 1 to 5, with 1 minor and 5 extreme. And there's a website there to go fit it out. And here's the big picture. This little X is the North Magnetic Pole. Here's the auroral oval. It's kind of hard to see, but there's a terminator here. The day is over here, night's over here. And some general comments on how these three disturbances, where they are, at least on the Earth. Geomagnetic storm can cause depressed F-region MUF, okay, at mid and high latitudes, both day and night. Geomagnetic storms also cause auroral absorption, but they also, of course, cause auroral ionization, which VHF guys really like. F-solar radiation storms, protons from a big flare can be funneled into the polar cap, and that's the area within the auroral oval. So any over the pole path could be affected. Let's see. the radiation, radio blackout, X-ray radiation on the daylight side of the Earth only, and they can cause increased absorption, so the bands kind of go away for a little bit. Next one, please. Now, in order from least impact to propagation to most impact, probably radio blackout is the least impact. We basically have no warning because, you know, electromagnetic radiation travels at the speed of light. By the time it gets there, when we measure it, things have happened already. Usually a short duration, an hour or two. Lower frequencies impacted longer. Only affects the daylight side. Of course, you're not going to be on the extreme low bands during the day. Solar radiation storm. There's a couple hours warning because the energetic protons aren't at the speed of light, but they're up there. So we have a little bit of a warning because we have satellites out there kind of monitor what's going on. They can last up to a day or two, and they not necessarily affect both polar caps the same, and that's because the protons come from outside our magnetosphere, or whatever. Geomagnetic storms, that's probably the most impact. We have a day or two warning because that solar wind, you know, maybe gets up to 2,000 kilometers a second. So we know that they're coming. They can affect high and mid latitudes. Interestingly, they can enhance the low latitude ionosphere. And in general, we want GSNR to be 1 or less. I'm not sure that's right. They don't have anything less than 1. Oh, well. You had to make an error somewhere, I guess.
It'd be good to be there.
It'd be good to be there, yes. Okay, next one. And what can you do about mitigation for disturbances? Well, you can go turn the TV on or something. I don't know. Put a movie in, yeah. What the heck. For geomagnetic storms, you can check for auroral propagation at VHF. You guys do a lot of work up at VHF?
Some of them.
Some of them.
Yeah,
but
FMTV
guys, we do all our work at VHF.
Ah.
We've only paid.
Yeah, okay.
You can go back in the day, there's a lot of work
for you. Okay. Remember I said for geomagnetic storms, that there's more, the precipitating electrons cause more ionization and lower frequencies bend more, so check for skewed paths, in other words, non-great circle paths. On the HF paths across mid and high latitudes, just move down in frequency. That's probably your only thing to do, really. Again, look for enhanced low latitude paths, you know, like southern USA to Australia. For a solar radiation storm, which is protons in the polar cap, maybe look the other way if you have the capability of turning your antenna, which doesn't sound like that happens too much. I'll make a point that there's an antenna that's coming on the market in ham radio. It's called a Waller flag. That's two horizontal loops, 180 degrees out of phase. Put it up on a tower and rotate it. So you do have, a mechanical rotation of it, and you can point it wherever you want. Interesting. It takes up some real estate. We'll see how it works. For radio blackouts, just try higher frequencies because, remember, if you go higher in frequency, there's less absorption, so try that. Next one. Okay, now let's go through a couple weeks ago. We had a real big problem. And here are the K indices. And this was the result of a CME or a coronal hole. We'll get into that. And, of course, when you see the K index that high for such a long time, you kind of wonder about a solar radiation storm. In other words, a big flare emitting protons or a big flare emitting electromagnetic radiation for a radio blackout. And this graph comes from there. Next one. So what happened on June 22-23? There were 3 coronal mass ejections, basically a day or two apart. And this last one was the fastest that caught up the other two. And that really caused a mess. Now, what I tried to picture here is, let's see which one is 134, 05. Yeah, here's the first picture. What that thing is an occulting disk. You can see the support for it. What it does is blocks out the sun, the major portion of the sun, so you can see what's happening in the corona-type area. And you can see, it doesn't show up here real good, but you can see that this ejection is all around the occulting disk. And that's why they call it a halo, because it's kind of like a halo around the disk, and it also tells you that it's Earth-directed, too, which is not good. For most of us, it's not good. So that's what eventually caused the Kay indices to go way up for a whole bunch of 3-hour periods. And this is an empirical ionospheric correction model that the Space Weather Prediction Center runs. What they've done is modeled the impact of the Kay indices on the F2 region and trying to predict how much of a change to the average F2 region is going to happen. You can see this is divided up to, this is northern hemisphere, here's southern hemisphere, and also three latitude bands. And you can see that those K indices and the resulting geomagnetic storm, the F region have all northern latitudes, went the wrong way. Pretty much the same thing in the southern hemisphere, high latitude, mid latitude, but actually at low latitudes in the southern, just below the magnetic equator in the southern latitude, the F2 region improved a bit. Interesting. Now what this uses is 33 hours of the past 11 K indices, which is 33 hours. To think that a single K index tells you what the F2 region is doing is kind of a very simplistic approach. And like I said, this model looks at how the K index has developed over the past 33 hours, and that gives a little bit better indication what the F2 region is going to do. So here's a way you can just go online and see if things are kind of normal or if things are, well, that's why I'm not hearing Australia. Next one. Okay, of course it caused all those high key indices caused the aurora. There seems to be some confusion. I'm sure you guys have seen this map, right? The auroral map. Now remember that what that is statistically where visible aurora can occur. Okay, that's all it tells us. It really doesn't tell us about radio aurora, but the higher energy particles that get down lower and cause problems. The detectors on there only detect, I think, electrons up to about 20 kilo electron volts. But the radio aurora stuff is much higher, and it blows right through the detector. So in general, the radio aurora stuff is on the equator edge here. And of course, this thing is not symmetrical because it's most intense on the night side, least intense on the day side. So just be aware when you're looking at this. This is just telling you where visible aurora could occur, and it's not even a real-time map. It's really a canned map based on many passes of the GO satellite. Next one. Yeah. Here's another interesting fact. Does everybody know that the magnetic poles are moving, right? The North Pole is heading kind of north-northwest. And who knows, maybe someday west coast to Europe may not be in an auroral path. Or maybe something else bad is going to happen and it won't matter. But, that's, if you extrapolate it, that's what's going to happen. Okay. The disturbances. What this graph is monitoring is electrons at geosynchronous altitudes. We got a satellite up there, 22,000 miles, just sitting there in one, stationary over the Earth. And it's measuring the electrons up there. And when you go to that graph, and when you see the electrons take a dip, that means they're coming out of geosynchronous elipses. The trapped electrons have been kicked out of the magnetosphere, and they're funneling to the northern and southern poles. So that's a good indication that something's really happening here. Next one. X-ray flux, all those K indices, like I said, were, you got to wonder about solar flares. And look, you know, starting June 21st, here's an M2.0, an M26, M38, M11, M6.5. So there were, you know, a bunch of flares, and of course this M6.5 was the biggest one. And solar flares are measured by the amount of radiation in the 1 to 8 angstroms, which is 0.1 to 0.8 nanometers. You mentioned picometers. What the hell is that? What the picometer? Oh, just kidding.
You don't want to know.
I don't want to know. Okay. But when you see that many flares, you know something's going to happen. Vicki? And sure enough, this is the proton flux. And you can see when those flares started. So that means there's a lot of protons, and they're getting funneled into the polar cap. And for over the pole pass, that's probably not good on the lower frequencies. Okay, next one. And here's another product from Space Weather Prediction Center. It's the absorption. And of course, when that flare hit, the solar radiation storm, in other words, the electromagnetic radiation on the day side, right there, went up significantly. That's why it's red. And you can estimate how much impact it was at each frequency. Now, the higher in frequency, the less the impact. So that's why you'd move up in frequency if this happened. And of course, the flares cause polar protons to go into the polar caps, and that's why these polar caps are all red. Now, this is a Mercator projection of the Earth, and that's why, you know, the polar regions don't look circular. That's how it comes out in Mercator projection. Next one. So, listening on the higher frequencies may not be productive for the next several solar cycles. Lower frequencies should generally be good due to small cycles, but it may be dependent on how small it is. Good area for more research. Shortwave listening on the middle frequency probably will be just fine. And there's also a lot of space weather data available to assess disturbances to propagation. Not only disturbances, just what, you know, what's going on right now, kind of on average. Okay, that's all I had, I think. Right? Yeah, there we go. Can't hear. Question.
I have one. I moved the projector back to the big picture. I've always been told that along the gray line,
mm-hmm.
you can expect magic on the other side. What's the mechanism that makes that happen? Or is that just maybe a lower frequency?
Well, for many, many years, I think people have kind of explained it by saying, well, something magical happens along the terminator.
Right.
The D region goes away, but the F region is still ionized. Well, when you start digging into physics, though, on the lower band, you don't really need more ionization. What's there is probably good enough. And the various layers of the ionosphere really don't do anything before sunrise. A lot of people, you know, if you draw a picture of the Earth, you know, the sun is tangent at ground sunrise, and it goes into the dark ionosphere. Well, it starts ionizing the F region and the D region and the E region. But when you look at that, remember I said the ionization process is an absorption process? So if a photon is, you know, that can ionize the F2 region, it creates an ion pair, creates another ion pair, then it's out of energy. So it generally doesn't get to the atmosphere even once to get to the dark side. Now, it's a very short explanation, but I think what really is going on, at least in the amateur radio world on the low band, it's a skewed path. In other words, the path stays in darkness, but it looks like, you know, like a path from, like from here to over to there. It could go along the terminator, which is hard to see there, but it's there. Or it could head off into the dark ionosphere where there's the least amount of absorption, and it can get skewed off into another great circle path, so it comes in the dark ionosphere on the other side. I think that's what's really happening. But regardless of the explanation, that occurs, and you should take advantage. You should always, on the low band, look at sunrise and sunset. Yeah. Don't know if I explained it too well, but
call it magic.
Yeah, the magic of propaganda.
I think that's how you use that word.
Yes, sir.
What might mean is the existence of solar flare that can wipe out the electrical grid and storm it out of the U.S.?
Probably not the flare. It's the geomagnetic storm that may accompany it. You know, like a coronal mass ejection and a solar flare, decades ago were thought to be concurrent, but they're not. They can happen together. One can happen, the other may not.
Now, we had one for Dorland, Quebec,
yeah,
not too long ago.
Yeah.
How much higher than that do you think we wipe out more than we have in the U.S.?
Oh, I think, okay. Remember that chart of the King indices back in June? It probably have to go a lot higher than that. I think they're for a long period of time. And what it does is it induces currents into the grid system. And that's just make the mess of it. I don't think it's the solar flare is not the issue. It's the geomagnetic storm. The higher K indices. Yes, Nick.
Is there a correlation between the solar flare and the
general, coronal mass ejections mostly occur at solar max, so when the solar flux is way up there, that's probably when. Now, I don't know if there's how much of a correlation there is, except for that general comment I just made.
Yeah.
It just
seems that, you know, the coronal mass ejections seem to be somewhat solar mass. You say, oh, where did that come from? And sometimes,
the K index is where it starts, and that's where we get the A index and all that stuff. The K index is mostly a mid-latitude measurement from observatories. Of course, there's the auroral electrojet at high latitude. It measures current at E region altitude up at high latitude. There's also a DST, big D, little ST, disturbance dark time. That's done at equatorial. That's from observatories at equatorial type latitude. Those three are, of course, correlated, but there's different measurements, so you see different things. And I know a lot of the VLF guys are looking at that DST measurement. Now, how well everything is correlated, I don't know. Whatever works. Yes, sir.
About 10 years ago, I got involved in a
college
aspect of the VLF topic, and that's a non-record.
Yep.
and how low they were hearing. So the higher the pressure, the better the performance.
Yeah.
Does that sound like this?
Well, that, you know, like I mentioned earlier, there's a tie between what happens in the lower atmosphere and how that couples up the ionosphere. So I wouldn't doubt it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff we just don't know. I mean, there's a lot. Yes, sir.
As a medium wave reactor for 50 years, I have some comments.
Okay.
Observations. First of all, the June 23rd aurora didn't clobber medium wave state up here in the higher latitude, but
okay.
It did not really have awesome southern perception associated with it. It's not medium wave. Whereas 3 months ago, or 3 months prior, excuse me, same time in March, around March 20th or 23rd, that also clobbered northern states that had great, or maybe not great, but quite good southern perception. Now, I'm wondering if the same thing was experienced on the, like the 160.
Well, in general, 160 has been so poor, I don't think many people get on. So,
okay.
So we have no data.
Okay. Yeah. All right. And another comment here is on medium wave. Right?
Mm-hmm.
All of us, most of us here are medium wave yet.
Yep. Yep.
And more so than short wave.
Yep.
Anyhow, the aurora skits in general, okay, the auroral effects in general are observed around sunset. Then if you get a couple hours after sunset, in general they start to dissipate. Unless you have an extremely powerful aurora, and very high K, very high A, and when they then they can go all night. The typical observations are aurora conditions are around sunset, 2 or 3 hours later, East Coast Asians coming in, KOA and Denver coming in, and the event is over. Same thing on the ham bands, or different? Again, I'm talking about the ones that are close to the end, like top band 160. Same effect?
I certainly don't listen enough to say that.
Okay.
And I'm not, I don't think I've seen any, I don't know if we've bothered to look.
Okay.
Yeah, it's probably there, but you guys are more focused on certain things than the amateur radio.
Here's a short duration conversation versus this
stuff
we'll
be listening to. Yeah. We're interested. You know, what's happening now? Can we contact that station now?
And
we're more long term.
The same token, reading like the top band or list is wonderful for me, because more than any other area of amateur radio, I think, the top banders are interested in hearing.
Yep.
Because they know that to hear, they're not being something a lot different from the world.
Yep.
That's right. You mostly look at the band.
You guys listen to the fishnet beacons at all? The one on 160?
Yeah.
You probably get a lot of those, don't you?
Yes. Sometimes I've been amazed at just how strong a amateur signal or a shortwave broadcaster can be.
Mm-hmm.
Or for that matter, a TV station when a completely different phenomenon is played, at least get the
clip.
And you talked about ionospheric dumping.
Mm-hmm.
Now, typically a radio wave in free space, in the absence of any barriers, there's the root mean square rule, which is to say, if you double the distance, the signal gets marked down to a quarter.
Mm-hmm.
Make it 10 times, you have 1/100 as much signal. If the signal is actually in a duct, where it's being kept in the same path, could it actually break the root mean square rule if it's not spreading out?
Could be, I guess. Yeah, never looked at it. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff I don't think.
And how much loss there is.
Yeah.
Isn't the thing about, you know, I find that a lot of times people just say, "Duck it, crawl, salt."
Yeah.
And I say, "Well, what is actually happening?
Yep.
What are the losses you're likely to expect?" And you know, that's a pretty good point.
You've
got a concentration. You don't have that, so there's a duck it rule anymore. You know?
Yeah.
This happens with sonar all the time. You know, you get a duck.
A lot of good comments and observations.
Yeah. But, you know, a lot of the stations that we listen to are much more dealing with.
They're not.
Cosmic Ray, you said,
It sure looks like it, yes. It adds more electrons down at the absorbing region.
I'm really glad to hear this, because I've always wondered about the physics of this, about defining the conventional wisdom that low frequencies are worse when some spot minimum is, and or at some spot maximum.
Yep.
I think a large part of it is people get up on higher bands and not looking in the lower band.
But oh, yeah.
I can remember at the height of sunspot cycle 21, I wasn't around for 19, that I would be listening to British television audio during the day, and then that night on a little transistor radio listening to KFI.
Yep. San Francisco, right? In Detroit, okay. Yeah, we do our DXing on the lower frequencies at night. So why should there be any real difference between solar max and solar min at night? Of course, if the path is near the terminator, you can have ionizing radiation scatter in from the daylight to the nighttime. So if the path's near the terminator, I can see why solar max would be worse. But there's more to this than that.
You mentioned at one point that the ionization effect starting a lot more rapid than it ending. We used to have an AFRTS transmission about 26 megs from the bank to the floor. When we used to do monitoring surveys, or even the relay station.